Now.
But okay, when people speak, you should say your name.
Say your name. Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so we're just going to talk about
our experience, stories.
SCLC.
Well, no.
Or are we going to talk about our whole history?
I think the question is, how did the movement affect you?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'll start off. My name is Richard Smiley, and I started out in Selma, Alabama, and I was born in Selma, and I got involved in the movement in 1963, where we was marching for the, we had sit-ins and restaurants and fair employment, and I ended up, going to jail every day. And then after Jimmie Lee Jackson got shot in Marion, I ended up doing the Selma to Montgomery March. I was there on March 7, 1965, Bloody Sunday. And I was there all three marches. I did march all the way from Selma to Montgomery. But I was living in a foster home. And my social worker had told me if I marched from Selma to Montgomery, that wouldn't have a place to stay. So I marched from Selma to Montgomery. When I got back from Montgomery, my stuff was sitting on the porch. But as there, I was homeless, and I was living in churches and all that. So a guy named Harold Millbrooks was in Selma. He was the SCLC he's the representative for that county, the director for that county. He put me on staff with SCLC. And then I started sleeping in the office that SCLC had in Selma. Then I moved on and ended up in Mississippi. But just to back up, I did do voter registration in Selma after I was put on staff. I tried to, the hardest person for me to register was my family. But then after that, the Mississippi March began in, I think, of June of 66. And I went there as a staff member at SCLC. So I completed that march. And after that march, I ended up going back to Georgia. I worked in a little town. They sent me to a little town called Dawson, Georgia. That's in Terry County, Georgia. We used to call it Turbo Terry, Terror. But they sent me in with a scope worker named Pat Lancaster and Evelyn Williams and Jackie Smith. We were the three that went into Dawson, Georgia, doing voter registration. After that, we had some real serious experience in Dawson. The young ladies got ran out of town. They had a $200 contract out on my life. And I think the only thing saved me was that Dr. King called a meeting in Atlanta at 7 a.m. in the morning, and we had to leave that night. So, but I was willing that I wasn't going to stay in. I was going out. The other thing is that after that, since I was a high school dropout, a guy named Bob Fitch knew a headmaster that ran a private school in Los Olivos, California, a school named Midland. And the guy, Mr. Munger, came to Georgia. I met him in Atlanta. He came to Georgia and interviewed me. And a month later, he said I could attend the school in California. But the movement and the scope project prepared me because, I'd never been in an integrated session, integrated in Selma, you're either black and white. So all the whites that came down from scope helped gave me the confidence even to attend that that high school. Because that blacks in during that time, we were taught that we was inferior, that white was superior to us. And after you hear that so long, it end up being a part of the baggage in your suitcase. So I had that baggage, and I attended a school that helped me to adjust. Even there, you know, they, I had some adjustment to do. But after I finished that year up at Midland, ended up going to community college in College of San Mateo. And I spent 2 years there, ended up going to Cal State University Hayward, got my BA degree, and I ended up at the University of Utah for graduate school. And, you know, I just have a lot of thanks for, you know, all the people that looked out for me because I was a young guy and, you know, didn't really have no family. So they, you know, kept me focused and gave me, you know, I don't know where I would have been today if it hadn't been for SCLC and the movement. So, you know, I owe all the thanks to SCLC, all the peoples that was involved in SCLC. And I think it was, I think it's amazing to see everyone at this 50-year reunion. And a lot of whites didn't see that it was just important. They gave up something that you came to the South, and you didn't know whether you're gonna make it back home. And I think that was a commitment, you know, that you came to a strange land. And didn't know whether you, because, you know, during that time, the police and the Southern whites was harder on you guys than it was us. All right, because we could blend in, but you stood out. And they always knew you was a nigger lover. And because I know some scope workers got arrested in Selma. It was a guy named Turley. He was married to a white lady, and they messed around in the jail that night and discovered they had the same wedding band on. Boy, they beat Curly, they beat him almost unconscious. So I just enjoy celebrating this moment.
It's a good experience.
Tell us your name again, because for the recorder.
My name is Richard Smiley.
Richard Smiley, okay. Right. And I was reading the instructions. We're supposed to each give our name quickly before
and then
we
go around. Huh?
Yeah, just quickly.
So my name is Harry Boyd.
And you are from where?
Living in St. Paul. Grew up in Atlanta. And my dad was on the SCLC Executive Committee from 63. And I worked as a field secretary in 64 and 65. And mostly worked in the Atlanta office some. But mostly in the citizenship education program.
Okay, good. Jim?
Yeah, I'm Jim Keck, and I'm from the Chicago area. And my involvement was in Chicago and with SCLC and 1965-1966, Dr. King came to Chicago, and I was 18 at the time, and became rather enamored with Reverend James Bevel and a guy named Jerry Herman. And basically worked as a field organizer during what was called the End of Slums campaign and an open housing campaign.
So I'm Jason Keck. I was born in 1972. My mother and father kind of met during that civil rights era, doing that work. And I was born in Chicago, but raised mostly in the East Bay, California area with my mother. And I currently live in North Carolina with my wife and two children.
Okay. It's nice to have you here.
My name is Bob Hurd. I was a staff member for SCLC from 63 to 65. And they pretty much had me troubleshooting on special projects, like to run an election in St. Augustine, Florida, except for the So I never really got to bond with a lot of people, except for the year that I worked with Mark Harrington. And we were on a team, revolving team, going from county, from town to town in different counties, making sure that the volunteers got along. If they had problems getting some kind of movement started, we were supposed to help them. If there was violence, we were supposed to write the violence out with them. So we traveled from Georgia to North Carolina. On our circuit. After that, I had a problem keeping a job because of my civil rights arrest. And so finally I ended up working for a not-for-profit in Chicago. Oh, I should also go back to begin. Before I started working with SCLC, I helped organize the first Chicago Board of Education sit-ins. And that kind of gave me a taste for getting involved in civil rights. And then I went down south, as I stated. And so when I went back to Chicago, I ended up working for a community not-for-profit. And there was hospitals were moving from the inner city to the suburbs with flight. And so we ended up suing them because they had got Hill Burton money. And so a lot of them ended up staying in the city because of the millions of dollars that they would have had to give back to the federal government. I also ended up being part of a group that put called Compran, and we put pressure on the University of Illinois at Chicago to increase their enrollment of minority doctors. And so now, although we had to fight with them then, now they brag about producing the second or third largest number of black doctors in the country. In addition to that, one of our board members at Compran was a member of the Tenant Advisory Council in Oakville Gardens, which is a public housing project. And so the State Drug Abuse Program and the Tenant Advisory Council was trying to get the Chicago Housing Authority to rent them an apartment for $300 a month to put in a methadone clinic. And the Chicago Housing Authority didn't want to have the clinic there. So my board assigned me to work with the board member. And as a result of the impact that I had and with help that I got from someone that I had met at SCLC named Betty Jones, who was working at HUD, they put pressure on the Chicago Housing Authority to give us an apartment. So we ended up getting two apartments for $1 a year apiece as opposed to paying $300 a month. And the State Drug Abuse Program was impressed, so they hired me as assistant director of community organizing. And I went out to various community groups that wanted to set up a methadone program, evaluate them, and made a recommendation to the director. And I had also been involved with the Inglewood Free Clinic.
You know, Bob, I think we're supposed to go around quickly and then come back to the story.
I'll be through in a minute. So the free clinics were dealing with everything besides methadone maintenance. They were dealing with LSD, with coke, with poly drugs. And so I ended up getting hired as director of the National Free Clinic Council and ran that for about 3 years and ran into Bill Traynor, who was also an SCLC worker who was running a youth program in Washington, out of Washington, D.C. And so we ended up collaborating on some things because I had youth clinics that were part of my network. And that pretty much gives you my background and the impact that SCLC had on me. Put me in a position of a lifelong commitment to justice.
Mark Harrington, I came down to Selma right after the Edmund Pettus Bridge situation. Remember, Dr. King held a news conference after that bloody Sunday, inviting Northerners to come down. And I lived in St. Louis at that time. And there were a couple of ministers who came to me and said, would you like to go down there, Mark? And I said, I really would. And they said, well, we'll be happy to pay your plane fare if you'd like to go.
You didn't give us your name.
Mark Harrington.
Mark, yeah. So I said, yeah, you're on. So I flew to Birmingham, and I don't remember how this happened, but somehow or another there was a school bus at the airport picking up people just like myself and drove us to Selma. And I lived with a family that lived in the housing that surrounded Brown Chapel.
I think it was the West family.
The West family? Okay,
yeah.
We could talk about that a little bit more, because I went back later to try to find them, and they didn't live in the same place. Anyway, okay. But anyway, and then when Selma was over with, there were the group of us that had worked with Jose to do the logistics for the march to Montgomery. He asked us to stay with him, and I said I would. And then that's how I got involved in SCOPE.
I'm Jack Finley. I apologize for getting here a little bit late. I was a 30-year-old college student, and I brought a bunch of our outsiders at the college, a little organization we had going, down to in February of 1966. Jim Bevel had called an organizing weekend to bring people in for the Chicago and the Slums 66 program. And he latched on to me and talked me into coming down, dropping out of college, and come and help him with stuff. So I came down, and we were located on the west side of Chicago, and I can't remember the church that we were at. I built a dark room in the basement and everything, and I ended up putting together a slideshow that was taken out to college campuses, I think primarily in the Midwest, to get volunteers for the End the Slums campaign. And during that summer, I was not really much involved, although we did have staff meetings, so there were some SCOPE people there. After putting the slideshow together, I decided to stay out a little bit longer. And they liked my pictures and everything. So at this time, Jesse Jackson was named National Director of Operation Birdbasket. And to his fellow students at Chicago Theological Seminary, their mentor, Dr. L. Pitcher, and Jesse Jackson, and the four of us, we started Operation Breadbasket. And I was sort of the gopher. Anything that anybody else couldn't do, that was my thing. But I served them for the next 6 years as a documentarian. I was in contact with the press, in charge of organizing people to make picket signs and stuff like that. And I never moved out of anywhere other than going to Frogmore, to the Penn Community Center, and some other places in the South for staff retreats. So I spent my whole time on the second floor on the corner of 42nd, and which now is Martin Luther King Drive. So it took me, I guess about 6 years before I burned out. And this was at the time when Jesse was fighting with Dr. Abercrombie. He wanted to take over SCLC, and it failed, so he started PUSH. And at that point, I had been seeing a brother who was, his full-time job was psychologist at Cook County Jail. And I think I probably owed my life to that man with a lot of other people along the line. But it took us a while, about 2 years, before we decided mutually that it was probably best if I wanted to regain any sanity that I may or may not have ever had before I joined the movement. But it was time for me to leave the realm of Jesse Jackson. So I resigned, and at that point, I don't really recall what actually happened in Chicago to SCLC, but Jesse took over everything over, the band and everything. I ended up spending another year with the original Rainbow Coalition, which was in north side of Chicago, and it was the community organization that was Native Americans, Appalachian people, black people, Latinos. There were people from the Caribbean and everything. They had a great thing going. Chuck Gary and a Reverend Iberus Hacker and what was her name? Dorothy, was it? Not Dorothy Parker.
Dr. Cotton.
Was it Dorothy Cotton?
Yes, Dorothy Cotton. They ran that organization, and I just hung out with them, and I lived in 22 different places during that 7 or 8 years that I was in Chicago. But anyway, during that process, I got involved with Studs Terkel, and the greatest interview that ever lived, I think. And I spent, he was going to do a book on black leadership and leadership in the freedom movement. And so I spent 6 hours driving in the passenger side with Chuck Gary, who is from, we went to his hometown, Horse Branch, Kentucky. Chuck was sitting there for 6 hours. He had a can in front, in between his legs, driving, and about every minute you go, he's a tobacco chewer. So I recorded him, had a lavalier around his neck, and I recorded him for the whole 6 hours. Ended up, when it was all over, and Stunts did some checking on it, just about everything that he had told me was bullshit.
Oh, that's terrible.
And, you know, I've met a lot of crazy people, you know, over the years and everything. I think probably the biggest one, and the guy that I really loved, was Jim Bevel. Jim got me into this thing, and the man had a sense of humor, and when he could use that for any time, he was just a master. And I just felt so sad about everything that happened in recent years with Jim, and I still don't believe all the stuff that, you know, that he was claiming done. Anyway, one of the things I'd tell you quick about Bevel, we had I'd say probably about 35, 40, mostly white kids off the college, 18, 19-year-olds that were there. And that first organizing meeting I was at, the lady from, I don't think she was from the Midwest, Betty, but I can't think of her last name, ended up with a big position in HUD after that, a couple of years after that. But she was in... Basically, the project they were working on was breaking the color line, the blockbusting thing, where it was, for years, the Chicago Real Estate Board had coordinated blockbusting, where one block at a time, every year, just about going further west, would be opened up, black people would be brought in, be overcharged for the property. White people moving out lost money on it. So anyway, Betty asked Bevel, "What would you recommend, Reverend Bevel, to for a woman of my age and white and everything, working here in the black movement and everything? What would be the best? What would you recommend for us? How to get along?" He said, "Well, I think the first thing that any white woman that wants to get involved here, and that's true for you know for white men." Get yourself a black lover, have a baby, spend 5 years with him, and whatever, and see what happens, you know. And that was Bevel's theory, is through integration in a number of different ways.
Is that how I was born?
That's right.
And that was, and he said, oh, by the way, he said, I'm available. And one of the persons that I had hoped to see here was Diane Nash Bevel.
Yes, right.
And I heard she was might be coming, but I haven't seen her yet.
I hope she whatever. Comes.
And there's just a lot of people like that that I knew from the Atlanta office and whatever. But we just had such great times together.
Okay.
Did you guys ever go to the Penn Community Center?
Yeah. You know, we're supposed to, Jack, we're supposed to go around pretty quickly.
Oh, okay.
And then go back.
All right. Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
Go ahead. Yeah, just give us a quick summary, and then I'll.
First of all,
but you're going to be facilitating.
I want to tell Jack that when I heard your name, I knew it.
Probably because I wrote you checks.
You what?
Yeah, I wrote checks for you. See, I wrote checks in Atlanta.
Oh, right. And I sent
them to Chicago. Yes. Yeah, okay. Yes. Now, my name is Melzina Maddox, and I'm from Grenada, Mississippi. I became involved in the civil rights movement, I guess you would say from birth, because I can remember even when I was a child when things would make me mad and I couldn't understand them, especially if anybody insulted my mother or treated her less than a lady. So when Dr. King finally came to town, it was like Jesus walking on water. Our entire town came out to meet him. And it wasn't just white people. People would think, okay, in Mississippi it's just black people. But it wasn't for me. I knew a family called the McCullers. And Mr. McCullers' sister worked in Jackson in a newspaper. And their children were Linda Brennan, Dennis David, Dorsey, Doug, and Daryl. I still know Linda Brennan, Dennis, Doug, Dorsey, and Daryl. I know all of them. But the thing is that during that time, when I got arrested, she came over to my house. We sat on the front porch. She brought a couple of kids with her. You know, she's fussing. She's mad. She's all of these things about what's going on in Grenada. So, you know, a lot of people have ideas about Mississippi, and it's right that they should. But there's some things and some people who didn't fit that category. And I was blessed to have known some of those people. Other than that, I worked in Grenada, and I worked with voter registration and demonstrating and integrating this, that, and the other. And Jim Harrison, who was the financial controller at that time, came to Grenada because he would usually visit whatever project was going on. And a young man from Montana had taught me how to write checks, and when he found out that I was, you know, in charge of the money in that area, he said he needed a secretary, asked me would I come to Atlanta. And my mother said, well, you've missed getting back in school for this session, so you need a job, why not just take it? So I did. I came to Atlanta. And from Atlanta, I got a chance to come to Chicago for the board meeting where they had that argument about who was going to be in charge of SCLC. I was also in Frogmore, South Carolina when we had our session there. Leon and I drove to Chicago for one Saturday meeting because we were young and we had nothing else to do. I was in Washington, D.C. for the Poor People's Campaign from like April until the state troopers put us off the mall. And I went to Memphis a couple of times and marched with Dr. King and the garbage workers. And I keep forgetting where all I was. Oh, I had an opportunity to go to Montgomery with Leon. And these were just things that I saw, places that I went, not places that I worked, but just places that I had an opportunity to see. Savannah and, Montgomery, Savannah, Birmingham. They kind of introduced me to a lot of things because I was kind of one of the last people in the movement. Before Dr. King died. So that was about it for me.
Okay. I'm sorry, I don't know your first name.
Melzina.
Melzina?
Yes.
M-E-L-Z-I-N-A?
M-E-L-Z-E-N-I-A.
Okay, yeah. Great.
Can I say something?
Yes, and then we want this gentleman
we
haven't to talk to.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
And then I have a suggestion. Yeah. I really liked what Richard had to say, because what Richard told us was not just what he did, but how it changed your experience in the movement, how it changed you personally, that you had these contacts with white people, and that kind of broadened your horizons, made you comfortable enough that you could go to that school in California, etc. And I think it would be interesting.
What the impact of
we're hearing right. What people did. And we kind of know what people did. I mean, it was a lot of stuff. But how did it change you personally?
That's a good
point. So let's start here and we'll work around.
That's a good
point. Unless your point is relevant to something else.
My point was relevant to you. I just remembered you. You know, because I was telling you that the West, where you lived at in the project, were 313 E, George Washington Carver home. And you said when you went back to this business, they had moved, they purchased a house on the other side of the town. And if you remember, she had a lot of children.
No.
She didn't?
No. It was the Brown family. I couldn't think of that earlier.
Okay. All right.
He worked as an auto mechanic downtown, a really big guy.
Right.
I mean, a really big guy.
Okay.
And his wife, they may have had one child, and I don't remember if that child was at home and then or not, but they didn't. Unless they had a lot of grown children that I never heard about, I think.
But I remember you in Selma.
Remember me in Selma, okay.
So, okay. I'm Harry Boyd. I grew up in Atlanta and then North Carolina. My father got involved in school desegregation in Atlanta. He was working for the Red Cross. And then he started working in Prince Edward County, Virginia, placing kids up north because they closed the schools. So we moved to Charlotte, got connected to Robert Williams. We had Freedom Riders camped in our yard. So my first experience was real alienation from the world I grew up in. I mean, my relatives disowned us. We didn't have anything to do with. They didn't have anything to do with us. But when Dad went to work on staff, he was very impressed with Bayard Rustin, whose name hasn't come up, but he was a political genius. And I remember hearing, I heard King practice "I Have a Dream" night before he gave the speech on my father's hotel floor. King was in the room next door. But I remember Dad talking about Rustin believed the movement had to win over the middle of America. It couldn't polarize. It's got to win over the silent majority. And then, so that affected me. And then I had an experience in St. Augustine when I was working for Dorothy Cotton in the citizenship education. I got caught by the Klan, Ku Klux Klan, and they said they were going to string me out. But I knew these guys. I mean, they were like my relatives. And so I said, they said, "You're a communist."
I'll call you later.
Communist and a Yankee. And I said, "No, I'm a Southern boy, and I'm not a communist. I'm a populist. I don't know where I got the term. But I believe that blacks and poor whites should get together, and you all are being played." So there was this old guy who said, "Well, he's the philosopher of the Klan." He said, "That's an interesting idea." He said, "I don't know if I am, but I am a Christian," he said. He said he is a Hinduist. Anyway, King heard about that story and assigned me to organize poor whites. And I did that on staff for SCLC in Miami next year, 65. And then I went to Durham. Well, I was going to school at Duke. And went to the poverty program, which was seen as a black power organization. And I went to the director and said, "I want to organize poor whites." And he said, "Well, why should we let you do that? It was a black power organization." I said, "Because I'm remembering what Rustin said, because you don't have, there's not a majority of blacks in Durham." Mm-hmm. So I worked for 7 years, with 1 year out in Chicago, at Chicago Divinity School. I worked for 7 years organizing poor whites in Durham, and we made a lot of alliances with the black community. So that taught me something that I think the movement needs to remember. That, I mean, I always ask young people today, why do you think King assigned me to organize poor whites? And most people can't understand it. They think, because, you know, some of these are Klan people. But like the other day, I was in a group of African-American young people, and one woman said, "Well, it's because they were oppressed."
They were.
She got it. Yeah. She got it. Mm-hmm. And so that's an important point that Rustin understood. You've got to find out people's interests despite their immediate hatred and prejudices. Can you build alliances? So that's what stayed with me. And I've written a lot about that. And in 1990, I started something called Public Achievement, which has spread to a number of communities here and in other countries, an effort to revive the citizenship education spirit, the empowerment theme, and that's the DNA of what public achievement is about. How do kids learn to work with kids who are not their buddies, who they may not like, who come from a different culture or background? Like in the West Bank in Palestine, we have a lot of public achievement working with across the religious divide, or Northern Ireland, or Hungary. And so that's the point. That's how it stayed with me. I really believe that we have to find ways to bridge differences around power, not a love-in, but actually around real power and interests if we're going to build a people's movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. One of the dynamics in the South for a couple centuries was simply playing the poor whites off against the poor blacks. Mm-hmm. So if you were poor white, you could feel good because there was poor blacks that were even worse off than you. And the wealthier families kept it that way.
Well, it was explicit. It was a strategy. But it was interesting when I said that to these guys in St. Augustine, they knew it was true. Mm-hmm. I mean, it had to be one of them who named it. But he said, I think you got something there. That was just how I survived. I mean,
and even though he had never probably thought it before?
Maybe not. He probably never talked about it before.
Yeah,
interesting. Just a couple of comments and then we'll move on. Bayard, my understanding, and I could be wrong about this, is that Bayard Rustin, in addition to what you're saying about the middle class or the majority, is that he wanted to have a demonstration in Washington, D.C., and that's how the March on Washington
came
about.
Randolph. It was A. Philip Randolph. But Randolph said, the Leadership Council came to Randolph and said, we want you to do a march. He was a great figure. Randolph said, I'll do a march, but I want Rustin to be the organizer.
Right. Okay.
Because he knew Rustin would be the person who could put it together.
So that's how that
But happened. Another thing I want to say, because I heard... So Rustin also was the person who mentored King in nonviolence.
Right.
It was not that King heard us about Mahatma Gandhi. It was Randolph sent Rustin down to King to talk to King when the Montgomery Improvement Association started.
Interesting.
And that's a story that really needs to be told.
Yeah,
I would like to hear more about that. So that goes all the way back to the mid-50s.
56. Yeah. In fact, Rustin kind of ghost wrote King's first speech on nonviolence. And got King to take the armed guards away from his house when he went down there. Mm-hmm. Rustin had argued for years that the movement needed to be nonviolent. So that's a very important piece of the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
So okay. I'm glad to finally meet you. You reached out to me a few years ago through that veterans...
Pardon?
To the veterans of civil rights. You emailed me, and we've been back and forth with emails, but we never met. So I'm glad to finally meet you. But anyway.
Yeah. But I remember you from St. Augustine.
Pardon?
I remember you from St. Augustine. I think you came to St. Augustine.
You were working there as a SCOPE worker?
Well, not SCOPE. I was with SCLC staff.
Okay.
I was in St. Augustine. Were you there at the same time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Was that the summer of 65?
64.
64.
Okay. I went back through 65, but I was mostly in 64.
Well, anyway, in terms of how it's made a difference in my life, what happened? I grew up on the city's west side of Chicago, and it was Warren Avenue Baptist Church is where the SCLC is, right?
Yep.
So I grew up just north of there, okay, in a working class Italian neighborhood. I'm not Italian American, but I grew up in such a neighborhood, and I was 14, 15 years old in a Catholic high school seminary. And what was happening in my neighborhood was it was starting to change with this blockbusting, blah, blah, blah. And the first reaction was, because I lived kind of in a mob neighborhood, they were burning people out, okay? Yeah. And our neighborhood just, like, flipped out. It was like, you know, suddenly there was all this violence everybody was scared to death what was happening, everything. So I, believe it or not, 15 years old, went to the local public library and asked the librarian what could I read about neighborhood change and whatever, and she turned me on to the original Saul Alinsky,
Reveille
for Radicals, and I was like 15 years old, read it, thought, man, this guy really knows this stuff, right? So I ended up, make a long story short, I ended up contacting Alinsky's office, trying to meet with him. I'm 15 years old, I want to meet this Mr. Alinsky, And he wasn't in town, but I could meet Tom Godet, who was one of his organizers. And the guy actually sat down with me. Think about it, 15 years old, this guy sat down with me and talked to me for 3 hours. And it left it with, if you can come back with $5,000 from your local Catholic pastor, I'll find an organizer for you. So like 15 years old, I tell my dad, and we go meet with the pastor, and he won't give me $5,000 for an organizer. So I got pissed off and was like, screw my neighborhood. You know, they don't want to do anything. And so I broke my hip in my junior year of high school, couldn't do my regular job, ended up at a Catholic priory in Garfield Park, washing floors, okay, and there was a core meeting there. And I'm like listening to these people, and they were after the same realtors that were screwing my neighborhood. Because back in those days, black folks used to fight panic peddlers for saying bad things about black people, right? I mean, they were a target of black groups, right? Black civil rights groups. And so I thought, well, these folks are fighting the guys that my folks won't fight, so I'm going to join these people. So I ended up with CORE, became a tenant union organizer, and then Dr. King came to town because there was a coalition, and CORE was a big factor in that coalition. And then I ended up, make a long story short, I ended up like on the north side staff of SCLC. You know, we were volunteers, we didn't get paid or anything like that. You know, I was working some side job.
What years were you there?
This was 65, 66, and I was like 18, and I just fell in love with James Bevel. And I just tagged along with him all over the place. I mean, I would just follow him anywhere. And his reason for tagging on to me was I was helping organize Catholic high school and college students to get involved in the Chicago Freedom Movement. So there was a one kid named Clarence who ended up becoming a pastor who did the public school ones, and I was doing the Catholic school ones. And I ended up getting to know, you know, Al Raby and different people, and one of the fun things was getting to know Dick Gregory, because he was very active in that the school fight over the Willis wagons and stuff like that. So I would be on marches.
Did
I would
you
be
work with C.T. Vivian?
You
must have been on C.T. too.
Say that again?
C.T. Vivian.
Oh, very much, yeah.
There were, this, you know, again, the perspective of an 18-year-old, Dr. King, Abernathy, Andy Young, everybody but Bevel, okay, were the old school, they were like old farts, okay? And James Bevel and, you know, James Orange, they like appealed to young people. So I just thought he was, you know, I just thought he was, I mean, he was, and the sense of humor, how funny it was. But how it changed my life was I came out of this working class Italian neighborhood. I'd have to say my parents were pretty good about, like, not being blatantly racist or something like that. Everybody, you know, they were devout Catholics and everybody should love everybody and all that good stuff. But the thing that really got me, and I to this day I say, is I grew up in this white ethnic neighborhood. I went to a school with the one black kid in my class passed for white, okay? I mean, that's how goofy those days were, right? And I'm introduced to all these black young people, including Reverend Bevel, right? And they're all, like, brilliant. They're all, they went to Fisk, they went to Tuskegee, you know? And I'm like surrounded with all these college people who are black. And in my neighborhood, kids went to the factory with their fathers, okay? And it's like, so my whole thing was about, in terms of racial inferiority or superiority, was like, I don't know, all the black people I know are more educated, more whatever, than any of the white people I ever grew up with. So I had like this idea that actually black people were cooler than the... But again, I was like exposed to all these college students, right?
Yeah. Just on
and
that.
I was, you know, and here I am 18 tagging along with people who are 20 and 21.
I got another thing on that. So when I was at Duke, and I learned this in the movement, mm-hmm. I mean, at Duke, the great intellectual was the janitor who was organizing the maids and janitors. And he had never graduated from high school.
Right.
But he could out-argue the faculty just like, you know, cutting through butter. And I met great intellectuals all across the South, African-American folks, mm-hmm. who didn't have formal degrees.
Right.
So I developed a lot of skepticism about what is supposedly credentialed knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very important impact on me.
So from there, in terms of what it changed, I mean, I ended up meeting Jason's mother in the movement, okay? And she was a Catholic high school student. I met her through the movement, et cetera. And after courting for 2 years, we married, and Jason followed shortly thereafter, okay? And what I ended up doing is I ended up becoming a professional community organizer, and I had quite a reputation in the Chicago area because I kind of mixed Alinsky organizing with movement organizing. And I mean, just real brief, I mean, to me, Alinsky organizing is kind of cynical, okay? It's always like people are motivated by the most base self-interest, whereas the movement, you know, talked about being altruistic and, you know, there's a bigger picture out there in terms of humanity. And so I kind of blended the two, and I ended up working in the white ethnic community because I was, by this time, I was really into Black Power. I had gone to Roosevelt University, Charles Hamilton was there, Staunton Lynn was there, all these kind of folks. And I sort of got into Black Power, and I was married to his mom, and I was like, I'm going to work in the white community. So I ended up on the southwest side of Chicago in a white ethnic community, and I organized them for like 15 years. My thrust was, it's not black people, it's the economics. It's the redlining of the neighborhood, it's the blockbusting, it's the FHA fast foreclosure schemes, it's all these things. And to divert the white ethnics from, it's all black people are trying to screw us, they're trying to take everything away from us, blah, 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 right? And I'm trying, no, you're being manipulated, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, and the long and short is Harold Washington, first black mayor of Chicago, right, comes along, and part of the campaign, sadly, was let's organize against the southwest and northwest side, these white races, blah, 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 blah. Make a long story short, I ended up being like this person non grata because here I've been in the working with these white ethnics and they wouldn't do what a lot of the mostly white liberals thought should be done in the city, blah, blah, blah. So I ended up being like this outcast for a while until somebody I knew from the movement days recognized who I was and said, Jesus Christ, Kekka's a former civil rights organizer, okay? And they introduced me, blah, blah, blah. I ended up in a meeting with Mayor Harold Washington. We became buddies. Took a picture with my son. Mayor Washington was
autographed.
Loved this guy. He was 12 years old, and he fell in love with him. Thought he was the greatest kid in the world. And it turned the whole thing around, and we made peace, and the white ethnics and the mayor made peace, and all that stuff. But so I'm picking up on, you know, how what it takes to go back into a white neighborhood and organize and coalition building and all that stuff. And all these names mean a great deal to me. And but again, as a young kid, I just get such a kick out of the fact. I mean, when you're 18 years old, you know, it's like Dr. King was an old fart, James Bellow, yeah, right, because he was, and he did have a great sense of humor. He was just, he was too much.
I'm surprised about anybody in Chicago.
I bet you did.
Because I did the nonpartisan referendum for Harold. Mm-hmm. I coordinated that. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the Southwest Parish and Neighbor Federation?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was my baby.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway. So that was connected to Baroni's network, too.
Well,
National Center on Urban Ethnic Affairs.
Later, my protégés got. Okay. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I ended up burning out basically at the age of 30 something, okay, and going through my second divorce. And ended up an alcoholic and ended up like completely switching gears and becoming a counselor. I'm a therapist. I'm like a graduate degree therapist and all that kind of stuff, retired. But still, I bring all that stuff even to my practice.
Yeah, I know your name, Jim, from the organizing world.
Yeah. How many years is clean and sober?
27 years. But it's fascinating because it's like, it kind of takes older folks to understand the times and the whatever. I mean, even during that Harold Washington thing, people didn't quite pick up on like, you know, a young crowd and sort of people were like what they call PC, you know, and it's like, man, you know.
Boy, I think the great hero for me was Byard Rustin.
Yes.
He was just a genius. Mm-hmm. He was a political genius.
I recently saw a documentary on him, and I was pretty fascinated by it, that I didn't hear him more growing up.
Well,
he
was gay, and he had been in the communist.
Yeah, that, they mentioned that in the documentary, so, and that's probably
movement kind of kept him out of the limelight.
Yeah. Well, back in those days, the other thing was, I came out as gay. That's part of my recovery, okay? But the thing is, so Boehner really meant a lot to me as I got to know who he was and et cetera, et cetera. But also, if you think in those times, you know, if you were gay or if you were a woman in the 60s, in the movement, you were kind of like First of all, gay people weren't out in the movement, except for Boehner, right? And then women were sort of like second-class citizens in the movement back in the 60s. You know, it was like more guys were more pushed forward, and that's why Diane Bevel.
Yeah, well, and Dorothy's role is not recognized. Yeah. I mean, she was also tremendous.
Dorothy
Cutt?
Yeah, that's true. Now, Miss Clark in Charleston, South Carolina, very, very well respected.
She was a tremendous figure.
Extremely respected in that area. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Being a woman at that time, for instance, you take Joe Freeman and the things that Joe went through. Mm-hmm. All of this time, and I didn't know that any organizations in Mississippi had anything to do with Joe Freeman leaving. But I do remember, because we were not close, I just admired her because of the stand that she took and the fact that she took photos and she wanted to be everywhere. I just knew that she would argue with Jose, and I knew that Jose finally had to get her out because he was so afraid for her.
Mm. Yeah. That's what I was going to say, that part of it wasn't that women was in the background. It was dangerous. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's why men took the lead, because we know during that time anyone could get killed. Mm-hmm. All right, and you get beat down, and being nonviolent, you know, you can't do too much to help them. So I think that might have been by design instead of by, you know, gender. Mm-hmm.
A little bit.
I mean, but it
also inspired a lot of women. The movement inspired a lot of women to go forward. I mean, Angela Davis, different people like that. I mean, were just sort of like.
And there were these tremendous women, like Thelma Craig. Did you know her?
No, I didn't.
In
the
Southern Alabama.
No,
she was tremendous. But
you know, go back to the Selma, the Montgomery March. If you look at that picture, there's no women on the front line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, when you start talking about Bloody Sunday, I look at that picture. There's no women. The women was further back in the line. Right. By the way, I was the number 17th or 18th person. When I got to that bridge and looked over there, I said, "Ooh, I think I'm in the wrong place." but it wasn't no women's in the head of that line.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was because of protection.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
And you know, especially, you know, it's a thing with black men that you know, during that time, we were trying to protect, you know, the females and, you know, black women's at that time. And I think that today we can say it was a gender problem, but then it was, I think, was more about protection.
Well, we were not privileged to information either. We were given assignments, but we were not always given the opportunity to say, be in a situation where we understood exactly what we were doing, why we were doing it, and how it was supposed to be done. And I do agree that it's good we were protected. I would have been just beat to death. I know I would. But, you know, we had Lester, we had Leon, and JT, and Tab would come through every once in a while, and Cotton Rita, Sunshine, and we finally caught on, but we were also, I believe in historical eras, and I believe that there's nothing you can do about the time that you live in except look at it and say that's what it was.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That's what it was. And to be honest, the women's movement hadn't even started.
No.
But I do remember seeing Joe's name when that came up, and I say, wow, Joe Freeman left Grenada, but she didn't stop, you know, and I was just really very proud of the fact that, you know, after the Civil Rights Movement came the Women's Movement.
And she played an important role there.
Yeah, and so now we're into every other kind of movement you can think of, but eventually I hope we live to see total freedom in the United States.
Yeah.
And one other thing before I shut up, Duke University. When we were in Frogmore, South Carolina, Dr. King wanted somebody to go to Duke University and speak to the sociology department. I had no idea what sociology was, but he sent Leon and me. And we spent the night on the campus. And
when was that?
I can't remember, but if you can remember when we went to Frogmore, then we can tell.
Because we went to Frogmore.
We formed a SCLC chapter.
Yeah,
it was the only campus chapter.
Uh-huh.
We turned our core chapter into an SCLC chapter.
But you know how our minds were, you know, after, like you say, you burnt out and Dr. King died and blah, blah, blah. It was something like in the 80s. One day I was listening to the radio in my kitchen cooking, and I heard him say something about Duke University. And I looked at my children and I said, I've been there. But things just vanished. I guess things that you didn't want to destroy you just vanished, you know? And I've had things to come back a little bit at a time, but I think I just wiped out a whole lot of stuff. Like I had forgot I had been to Chicago. I just didn't want to remember because so many things were so painful. But I'm not going to tell you all about my pain, because I'm sure you had your own.
I think it's hard for people to, sometimes it's hard for people to deal with. Yeah. Like Dorothy Cotton, everybody should know, she wrote a great book called If Your Back's Not Bent, The Role of the Citizenship Education Program. Mm-hmm. But it took her 40 years to write that book.
Yeah.
It was not an easy book to write.
I can understand that.
You know, we talk about... You know, one of the things I still live with today in Mississippi, during the Mississippi March, we was in, I think it was Greenville, Mississippi, or Greenwood. We went in and we saw the policemen coming in. We thought they was coming in to protect us. And they came in and they started shooting tear gas. And it was an older lady that I tried to get to. And I never could get to it because of the tear gas. So those are things like you know, I remember, and you know, I always have flashbacks of that. And you know, I think that go back to what we were saying. I think that it was a lot about protecting you. And and someone say about Jose Argo. Jose used to argue with everybody. It didn't have nothing to do with male or female. And if you work with Jose, you've been fired. If you haven't been fired, Jose didn't like you.
Oh, I'm telling you. God, he fired Cotton Reader every day, and Cotton Reader called me. Cookie, did Jose really fire me? Cookie, you're not going to write me no check. Oh, my God. And do any of you know Cotton Reader?
Yeah, I know Cotton Reader.
You knew Cotton Reader, but y'all didn't know Cotton Reader. Cotton Reader was what, Richard? He wasn't violent, but he was psychologically what? I don't know. But Cotton Reader was the kind of person that could worry you to death.
That's what I was gonna say. Yeah, he could get on your nerves.
And it never hurt him, never stopped him. But if he latched on to you, and Lord, he latched on to me. He could worry you to death all day, but we loved him so much. We loved him so much when he passed away. Jesse came from Chicago to deliver the eulogy. I mean, it was just like, oh my God, because we didn't know where he was, and we finally found him. When we went to see the statue in D.C., Cotton Reader was on the bus, and oh my God, and I said, Cotton Reader, is that you? Where in the world have you been? Well, he had been married, and he had preached, and, you know, he had done these things, but he was in a wheelchair at that time, and, oh, Lord, Richard, it started. Cookie, is that you? I said, yeah, Cotton Reader, it's me. Cookie, is that you? Well, put it like this. You know when a baby starts talking, and they repeat things over and over and over. Yeah. Oh, my God, Cotton Reader could drive you crazy.
Right?
I guess so. But now, as far as I'm concerned, Cotton Reader was the bravest person I ever knew. Yeah. He would stand
was he in
up
the Atlanta
to
office?
Anything.
He
yeah, he worked in Greene County, and he worked in Grenada, and I don't know wherever else he worked.
He worked all over.
He worked all over, and he came out of California, and from what I understand, he was in Selma for that march, wasn't he?
Well, he's there for the 5-day march.
Okay.
Now, did you ever meet my dad? My dad was in Selma, and he was, although he was...
I remember Boyd.
Boyd, yeah, right. That was my dad. Right. So he first went into Selma as a spy, because he could act like a, you know, Southern journalist.
Uh-huh.
And he just got to know the power structure and what they would do. And then he was at the Selma. He was at the bridge, but he was on the other side.
Right.
And he was taking pictures, and they beat him up.
Right.
And they tore apart his camera.
Right.
You remember that?
I remember they took a lot of you away there, for even they attacked the press during that time.
Did you know Dorothy Tillman?
Who?
Dorothy Tillman.
Tillman.
She's from Selma.
Yeah, I know Tillman.
Yeah, she was on the bridge at, I think she was about 18 then.
Right.
And she came to Chicago and all of them.
Right.
We tried to locate her, but convince her to come here.
Yeah. I didn't say this in my first part, that even when I went to that private high school in California, she was still writing me out checks. because...
Was she doing any work?
Well, what happened was that I didn't have any family at the school, and this was something that, you know, they'll give me just to, you know, make it on that, as, you know, buy certain things, you know, on campus. So they did still got a check that year that I was at that school until I started attending community college.
They subsidized you.
They subsidized.
So, yeah, I wanted to say something about the... Every community I was in, St. Augustine, Eastern North Carolina, there were a couple of whites who were supportive of the movement.
Right.
And they were often run out of town.
Right.
I remember meeting some people in St. Augustine, and they were run out of town.
Right. And the ones in Selma was afraid to speak up. I got a DVD about the 45th anniversary where they interviewed all the whites, including the Ku Klux Klan, was during this time. And a lot of people said they were just afraid to stand up.
A lot of people were afraid.
Yeah, most definitely. Because I can remember, you know, once you leave the civil rights movement, it does not leave you. Mm. It doesn't leave you. You're constantly teaching and you're constantly analyzing. And when I finally did get a degree after just going through four colleges, I did. I was just... Put it like this. My mother came over to my house one day and said, it was your father's dream that all five of his children be college educated, and I want to know when you're going to get your degree. So I said, okay, mother, I'll do that. Unfortunately, it was during the Reagan administration, and I really shouldn't have quit my job. But I did. And I went back and I got my degree, and I got it in sociology, even though I wanted it in history. But the thing was is that during that time, my husband was working with a young man named Bobby, and Bobby was white, and they put on floors, and he had a brother who also put on floors. And he and Bobby were very close, and they would call each other their homeboys and blah, 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 blah. Except when Bobby was around white boys, it was altogether different. So he came home one day, and he was all disturbed. Now, my husband was from Chicago, and he was in Gage Park. You know, so he knew something about what had been going on in the civil rights movement, even though at a very young age he was off in Vietnam. So I had to explain to him then, don't treat Bobby any different than you've been treating him, because you're free to take Bobby to your neighborhood, and you're free to enjoy Bobby's company. You're free to allow Bobby to enjoy your friends and be just a regular guy. And I told him, I said, Bobby is not free yet. So he can't do that with his friends. He got to live with these people. They may hurt him. You know, so you have to understand that there is still a divide here. So that, my husband might not have been very smart, but he was, I would say you would say he's kind of, that word to the wise is sufficient. So some things he would listen to, and that was one of the things he listened to, you know. So he and Bobby continued to work together, and they continued to be homeboys, you know. And we wrote a letter to the gentleman that they worked for. They were all about the same age, and found out that he had passed away, and it was very sad. Because my hometown is small, you know, so you know everybody, whether you like them or not, you know them, you know. And you know that family. So it was difficult for my husband being from Chicago, and it was also difficult for white people to deal with him because he was nuts. I even had people would call me and say, tell your husband don't come to our office no more. Don't do this, don't do that. And I would have to tell him, I'm, you know, sorry, you know, for whatever problem you might have. But my husband was born and raised in Chicago, and he is not going to act like a Mississippi black boy. He's just not going to do it, you know. And even, you all got to hear this. I know this ain't got nothing to do with civil rights, but like I said, you continue to teach. My children. My children went to school in integrated school. So they had these little white girls who were their friends. And one day, one of my kids came home to tell me, Mama, one of their girlfriends who was white said somebody was messing with her because my husband had a reputation. You don't mess with his kids, you know, in our hometown. You don't mess with his kids, and you definitely don't mess with his daughters. So this man was messing with me, and I told him my daddy was Maurice Maddox, and if he didn't leave me alone, I was going to tell my daddy. And then she told him to tell, but it worked. It worked. I mean, she actually, this is a white girl, she actually used my husband to make somebody leave her alone.
That's good.
You know, it's funny how once you get involved in this, it stays with you forever.
Yes, it does.
Like, I had just got back from California coming to Chicago and looking for a job. And I turned on the TV, and this news commentator is laughing at how silly it was for Harold to challenge the nonpartisan referendum because they had over 100,000 signatures more than they needed. So I immediately got on the bus, went down to the campaign, and 3 days later I'm running the nonpartisan referendum. I ended up sleeping in the office because I would sort stuff in the morning so that stuff from the 14th Ward would be at this table, stuff at the 21st Ward would be here. When I first came, a lot of people were just sitting around because they were waiting for the same binder books. So I coordinated all that. And like I said, I ended up sleeping in the office because I had a lawn chair under the table. And the lawyers would wake me up when they had some questions they wanted to talk about. And we ended up getting three of, Daley was the state's attorney then. And we ended up getting three of the attorneys in his office convicted of vote fraud because when I was sorting these petitions, I saw the same names but with a different signature on the bottom of some of them. And so at that point, I gave it to the lawyers. And so three of the attorneys in Daley's office got convicted of vote fraud, and they gave them probation but told them they couldn't be involved in civil rights for a year, I mean in voter registration for a year. So I said, I didn't send him to jail, but I got him to have to stand in the corner and take a time out for a year.
Absolutely.
It took me 60 years to get my degree from start to finish. Mm-hmm. And then they had to backdate it for 20 years mm-hmm. after I went in and said, fix me up. Mm-hmm. I had, I think, probably the three... at least two of the most significant days of my life that affected me was one, the Gage Park March. That was the scariest one. Going down a sidewalk with the skinheads and Klans people without wearing any hoods and stuff around with just a matter of couple of feet from him, and as we ended, we had gotten off from the street that had houses on it. We were by the park, and a brick missed me by about that much, back of my head, and it hit Dr. King. And within about 5 minutes, we went back to our cars. We had about 10 cars were burned. That was the scariest time. The saddest time was when Dr. King's funeral procession here in this town, I was running the press corps headquarters. And I had to watch all this stuff on TV. I couldn't get out there in it. But I was just totally overcome that day with it. Finally, it just sunk to me that, you know, Doc's gone. One name that I haven't heard mentioned is one of my heroes, Jim Lawson. I think he was, you know, another mentor to Doc. And he's still plugging along. I've been to, in the last 10 years, I've been to only about six of his workshops that he puts on nonviolence. What did it do to my life afterwards? Well, I burned out. It took me a long time to realize that things were wrong in this world that I was living in with Operation Breadbasket. I got out and I worked for Uptown Poor People, as I think it was called, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Chuck Gary and I can't remember other names. That's one of my problems that I have, both short and long-term memory loss. And I also can't hear very well. In fact, I'm getting a set of
hearing aids
next week. I wish I would have had them in today because I missed so much of the stuff that people were talking in there. But anyway, one of the tiredest days I ever had was one of the times when we were coming down to a retreat in Atlanta, and there were about six or seven of us in a Volkswagen van coming down through the mountains, and we were one of these nights when they had one of the greatest spectacular of fireworks in the sky. I forget what it was, this shower of meteors and everything. And coming from that, and having come down to eat in a restaurant with our mixed crowd and everything, and here were hunters with their shotguns in this restaurant, and just next to them, you know, at the table and everything like that. These are guys that are getting ready to go out and go deer hunting that morning. And we got into Atlanta, and everything was closed up. We couldn't get any place to stay, so I ended up sleeping that night on Dr. King's couch. That was the tiredest day. So, you know, all this stuff, you know, combined, and I was caught up in a lot of the, you know, the mystique and the charisma that Jesse had. But one thing that was really interesting, it started me thinking, was at another retreat. And one thing I realized, anytime Jesse and Jose were ever in the same room, there would be an argument of one form or another. And usually it was South versus North in terms of where SELC was giving its support and everything.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was at the Chicago Theological Seminary in a meeting room. There were probably about 30 of us there. And Jesse was really pushing Breadbasket and what he wanted to do with it. And basically, it was working with black entrepreneurs, breaking the, I guess what you call the boycott of black products and black services and employment in the large industries in Chicago, grocery stores, bottling, dairies, and stuff like that. And there were black entrepreneurs who needed to get into that market. So anyway, His emphasis was on that it was an economic thing primarily. And we came out of this one meeting for a break. And I was standing next to Jesse, and Doc came up. He says, "Jesse, I just want you to know that I have not spent the last 15, 20 years of my life to go down in history as being one of the principals in developing a black bourgeoisie business structure that's as corrupt, as self-serving as the white one that exists today." And at that point, it was really, I think, sort of the breaking point where Jesse went one way and SELC went the other. I really like hoping to have a little more time
I'd like to mention somebody's name that's not here. We weren't able to get in touch with him. A young white boy named Bon Perry from Boston had came down to what's the town?
Americus?
Yeah, to Americus. and no, to Crawfordville. And we were integrating the local church. And Vaughn's father was a minister, and he was very religious, and he was dressed for church with suit and tie. And the white minister turned out services when they saw us coming. And so Vaughn knelt down to pray where the minister stopped him. And the minister grabbed him by his tie and was trying to pull him up to his feet. And I had a camera, and so I was filming all this. And the sheriff snatched the camera, but I had the strap around my wrist, so I broke loose and I start running. There had never been violence in Crawfordville before, but you could feel the electricity in the air when the sheriff said, "Get him, don't let him get away." And so I started running. And the car was parked about a block and a half away. And I knew if I slowed down to get in the car, they were going to catch up with me. And if I ran out of town by myself, I'd be in trouble. But fortunately, one of the guys in the car opened the door. So I slammed into the door and pulled it closed behind me. And the guy driving the car, the motor stalled, and he was panicking. And I was telling him, you know, just stop and wait a minute. They can't get in. And as I'm telling him this, glass from the back window is hitting me on my neck, right? Mm.
Yeah.
So I go ahead and tell him, you know, go ahead and try it again, and we drive out of town. So I'm supposed to be going back to Atlanta. And then this little young girl, about 14, who was one of the youth leaders, said, "I'm scared to go back into town for the high school baccalaureate, but if you hold my hand, I'll go." Mm-hmm. And I know that the sheriff is mad anyway, but I could not let her down. So we walked into town, and the sheriff pulled up in front of us, and he said, "You're under arrest." I said, "Me or all of us?" And he says, "No, just you, Negro." And they put me in the sheriff's car, beat me up, took me to jail, and beat me up again. But I couldn't let that little girl down.
Well, one of the most important things that happened to me after the movement, because everybody say burnt, just kind of burned up, but I shut down.
Mm-hmm.
I could not talk to people. I couldn't make people understand how I felt inside. I could say words, but I just knew that everybody else's mind who had not been where I had been or around people I had been around just didn't feel the same thing or understood the same thing or whatever. And the two people that I used to talk to for a long time, because I stayed in my hometown 18 years, but I talked to Leon up until the time that he died. And I talked to Marion, and Marion just passed away a year or so ago. Those were the two people that I could talk to. Yeah, one of them passed away. But Leon was the one who set me on the path to actually trying to recover. He said, "Cookie, we have been in a war." He said, "And we're not going to have any counselors. We're not going to have any psychiatrists. You're going to have to handle it on your own." And that's what we had to do. But it took me roughly 18 years before I decided I wanted to just open up and be me again. And I graduated high school with people that I went to first grade with, and I still did not have a good talking relationship. I would talk to my mother, and strangely enough, my mother and I integrated the elementary school in Grenada, and I was so proud of her. She wound up with a certificate and everything, you know. I think my mother probably could have shot somebody. I mean, that's the kind of person that she was. But it was hard. It was very hard to just reach back and pull up memories. And like I say, a lot of things I just wiped out of my mind. I didn't want to remember.
Yeah, I think it is kind of like a war. I mean, that's a good metaphor.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a hard time dealing with memories or reading anything about the movement. But, you know, I think about the violence all around.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just put it aside. I mean, I remember, I had an experience in St. Augustine. The first time I went there, I overslept, and the bus went down to Daytona. And I came back, and I went to the SCLC office, And there was only one person there. I said, so where's everybody? They said, they're down at the church at the end of the street. I went down there. There must have been 100 people around the walls of the church on cots, you know, having beaten bloody, because they use bricks and they use billy clubs.
Yeah.
And my dad had really been beaten. So I said, well, I guess we should go, because we were going to go out to the SCLC beach cottage. And dad was beaten up, so we went to a motel, and as soon as we got there, the shotgun blast came through the window. And then the beach cottage, we went out there the next day, and it was like Swiss cheese. The clan had surrounded it and shot at it from every angle. So if we'd been out of the beach cottage, we'd have been, you know, blown away. But on the other hand, people were so brave and courageous that there was a lot, you didn't let it stop you.
No.
But I do think there was a cost to that.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of suppressed it.
That's something that most people don't realize, is that we suffer from post-traumatic shock syndrome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we weren't aware. That's probably your alcoholism.
And we didn't have a name, way to name it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So a lot of us went through a lot of trauma trying to adjust after going through all that violence.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, I know we have a lot to talk about, and it seemed like we're in a healing state now. And I was wondering, could you request that we continue this, you know, because this group's supposed to be over at 12:30. And
what is it, about 10 to 1 now?
Yeah, 5 to 1.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, could we continue this, because I think it's important to talk about our past, talk about where we're at now, psychologically, what scars we had, because there was some scars.
Yeah.
So I would like to pursue this.
I think that's a good
this.
Suggestion, Ooh. Richard. Yeah, yeah. I'll speak to Joe and see if we can't continue this. But if anybody wants to eat lunch, we probably need to do it now. Cause we're